Hello and welcome to We Make the Future, brought to you by PyTOL. I'm your host, Andrew Webb, and in these audio interviews, I'll be meeting teachers, thought leaders, scientists and students, and exploring the future of education, making and technology. Here's a taste of what's coming up in this episode.
The Industrial Revolution model of education needs to die. It'll be one of those things in the history books where we look back and go, wow, we really dropped the ball on that. You can suppress the arts for a while, but you can't suppress it forever. Humans by nature are makers and artists. It's one of the very first things we put on cave paintings. We wanted to draw, we wanted to create.
Now, this episode is all about makerspaces, how to design, use, and crucially, how to fund them. So who better to explain how to do all that than Nicholas Provenzano, aka the Nerdy Teacher. Nick is the author of a new book entitled The Maker Mentality. And incidentally, stay tuned to the end of the episode to find out how you can win a copy of Nick's book as well as a shiny new pie top. I caught up with Nick. Here's what he had to say. Hello, Nick.
Hello.
Hi, thank you for joining us here on the PyTOP podcast. I'm going to jump straight in to talk about your new book and get a sense of what made you write that. But first, before we even get to that, I want to start with a really simple question. For those that might not know, describe what a makerspace is.
Wow, it's a great question to start off with, because you'll actually hear a lot of different answers from different people. And I like to say, you know, that it's quite simply any location where you allow anyone to create. You know, makerspaces need to be tailored to the users, and they also need to be able to evolve as people's tastes or wants or needs evolve as well. So really, in the best world, every classroom is a makerspace. Every school is a makerspace. That part of your house where your kids play and create is a makerspace. So, you know, in terms of educational makerspaces, they tend to be specific locations that have specific tools that are best, I don't know, placed in one area so that kids can, from the entire school, can go through it over the course of a day. But I like the broadest sense of a makerspace, because I would love to see a world where all classrooms, all schools see themselves as makerspaces. And, you know, that's sort of what led to my book about the maker mentality, which is about this culture of making that needs to be throughout schools and classrooms if we want to see successful makerspaces and really successful students moving forward.
I like the fact that at the back of the book, you kind of list the things, some of the things. You're sat in your makerspace just looking around, just doing an inventory, basically. And I think part of the problem is when people hear about makerspaces that they think they need like pillar drills and like, you know, great loads of equipment and all this health and safety and glasses and this kind of stuff. And you list some quite simple things like sticky tape and cardboard and, you know, a few bits of this, that and the other and all that kind of craft stuff as well. I think that's really nice. Do you think that people are put off by the fear of the resourcing it and supporting it and the amount of equipment they think they need?
Absolutely. One of the top questions almost like right after what is a makerspace is, how do I afford this? You know, that's the big one. And, you know, I can point people to how they can get local businesses involved in supporting schools and grants and, you know, government support. But ultimately, I say your space is whatever your kids need it to be. And it should start off small anyway. Start off with traditional crafts. Start off with Legos and Play-Doh and all the things kids have used their entire life already, you know, things that they've used at home and played with. And then from there, you start to see what it is that they might want or need. And it might be a 3D printer, you know, and over the years, those have become extremely accessible in terms of price and size. 10 years ago would have been unheard of for a school to have multiple 3D printers. Now you can get a desktop 3D printer for around $600, which is still a lot, but it's way cheaper than the $6,000 it would have cost to have a gigantic one in your space accomplishing the same thing. So you just need to see what works. And I have kids that don't touch a single piece of technology that are in my makerspace every single day. It is yarn, cardboard, glue guns, glitter, scissors. They're there just to craft and make, and it's awesome.
So that's the space. Let's move on to the learning that happens within it. Just talk to me about the sort of project-based learning, the collaboration, the context, and problem-solving, and all those sorts of things.
There's really two approaches to learning with a makerspace. One, there's what I'd like to call free make, which is essentially the space is available for kids to come after school and just create, just to make whatever it is they want. And through that, they will learn things that are interesting to them. So the kid wants to come after school and says, I really want to practice coding. They can jump on one of the PyTop seeds and start coding, and they can just start learning that process, and they can start to practice physical coding if they want. So they're learning things that they want to learn through their own creation and making, and that's important to me. And if they work with cardboard, they're learning about design and the physics of holding things together and things like that. So that free make is always an important part of a makerspace, is that your space should be open and accessible to kids to learn what they want to learn. The other half of it, right, is through the instructional aspect of it, where kids have been given a task by a teacher. And through project-based learning, the kids need to demonstrate understanding through the creation of something. And so that's where a makerspace really comes in, because now it's giving kids access to tools to really expand the possibilities for how they can demonstrate what they understand. And so for me as a makerspace director in my school, that's where I get to co-teach and co-plan with teachers for these projects, so that we can support the students and what they want to create. And so those are like sort of the two approaches to using a makerspace for learning. And one isn't better than the other. You know, a kid might never come to a makerspace on his own to learn something for themselves, but they might get down there because of the teacher and realize, oh, wow, like, I didn't realize I was totally into this. Or, wait, so I can, like, use a laser to cut things? Okay, I'm totally listening now. What, you know, what can I do? So it's fun, because people will say, well, how does a 3D printer teach, you know, how's, you know, an important skill, or how does using a laser cutter a skill? And I always say using a copy machine isn't a skill, but if you draw something and want to make a copy of it, it's the drawing that's the skill that you're learning, right? And the same thing for a laser cutter or a 3D printer. It's the design that you're doing on the front end of it, not the cutting or the printing on the back end. And so it's understanding that it's a design process, not necessarily the printing process, that is where the learning is happening.
What is the value of makerspaces over traditional classrooms?
I always look at science rooms, labs. You know, those are the traditional makerspace / classroom, right? Kids are at lab tables, there's instructions, and then the kids go and perform the lab. I think that is probably the closest parallel to what you're going to see with a makerspace, where schools, unfortunately, the way they've been designed, and some are just have been around so long, it's impossible to just, I don't know, tear them down and build a new model. As we, you know, we've learned so much more about learning spaces and how they impact students. And so right now it's a mad dash to find space to create the things that science tells us we need and research says we need to support, but we're limited by literal walls. So it's really, really tough. So I always point to kindergarten classes or science classes as wonderful examples of what classroom makerspaces look like. They're designed for kids to stretch out, design, create, test things out, and then like present. You need to break that mold of kids sitting in rows, you speaking to them for the extended period of time, and then doing that over and over and over again every single day, and saying how you can take that instruction and now move it to a space where the kids can say, hey, this is what I learned during that instructional pieces. So it would be great to see classrooms look more like a combined version of those, where you could do both. You're starting to see schools that are being built think about that and implement those. And I've talked with some of those new designs, and you know, they have the idea of what it needs to look like now, and that classrooms are no longer four walls and 30 desks in rows with the teacher at the front. So we're moving away from it. It's tough, especially here in the States, when you have buildings that are 80, 90, 100 years old and the community is built around it. So there's no way for us just to build a new school like right next door or something like that. So they're doing their best to sort of find the space. And that's why you see a lot of makerspaces being placed in libraries.
Talk to me about the five common mistakes that people make when trying to create a makerspace.
So I'd say the first common mistake is location. Some people think that a makerspace needs to be in a classroom that's locked up over the course of the day and it's only accessible to students when a teacher takes a class there. It always drives me nuts to see that because it's not a makerspace, then it's just a regular classroom. And I think that hurts it because a makerspace needs to be a space that is free for kids to come through at any point of the day. In that teacher can bring their class at any point of the day. And that a kid shouldn't have to like stare in behind this like locked door at all the tools in there. Because learning happens whenever, and we want to have kids have that opportunity. So I always say that we need to advocate for places that are open and accessible. And that's why I think libraries are so great, because they're already staffed with librarians. They tend to have the space usually. Since computers have become more accessible and kids can bring their own devices, you see a lot of former computer labs being turned into makerspaces, which is, you know, something I say, if you can do that, because the idea that we all need to be in one lab together on computers at the same time is crazy. It used to have to be that way because kids didn't have, you know, portable devices, but that's a good way to evolve a library. Mm. And a library is a learning hub. It's a perfect spot for a makerspace. You know, I think it fits really well there. Second mistake is spending all of your money without talking to any students. It's something that I unfortunately see where they say, well, we got this grant and we have to spend it all. And no one even sat down with some students and say, what are the type of things you want to do? And they bought all of these 3D printers, or they bought a laser cutter, or they bought a CNC machine. And the kids are looking at all this stuff and said, we really just kind of want some makey makeys and some Play-Doh. Like, that's what we want to play with. And, you know, they've spent $20,000 on things that they're not being used yet because the kids haven't had the capacity build up to get to that level of making. It's so important to just sit and have those conversations with them and just say, what do you guys want to do? And ask them, hey, we're thinking about maybe these three things. Do you think you could use those? And you might say, oh, the kids really do want 3D printers. They have no desire to use a CNC machine. So let's just get an extra couple of 3D printers instead. And then when we're ready to get those other things, you know, they can find the way to raise the funds for that. But I've seen far too many spaces with tools that just have dust on them. Mm. And dust might be cool if it's sawdust because you're working, but it's not. It's dust and cobwebs and being unused. So that's important, is to have those conversations. Three, the next part of that is that you need to talk to teachers. Again, some of these spaces in, you know, I admire administrators that like see makerspaces and they're like, we're going to have this, we're going to put it in, and it's important. And then they do it, and then they forgot the whole part where they talk to teachers and provide professional development or just say, hey, here's a cool space. This is why we're building it, or we're heading this direction. And it's frustrating because, you know, having, you know, being a teacher, you know, 15 years, 16 years now, with classroom experience, I've had those administrator initiatives that seem to happen out of nowhere. And all of a sudden we're told, okay, here's this thing. I want you guys to use it and learn it and good luck. And like they kind of wash their hands of the situation going, I did my part. But you need to have teachers as a part of this conversation. So if you're going to build a space, have those early adopter teachers. We all know who they are. I was one of them. Bring them into the meeting. Grab some of those kids and say, hey, this is what we're doing. What do you think? Because you need to build up this excitement. You need to get those teachers on board so that they can tell other teachers, hey, we have this awesome space. We're going to have these cool things. And I know you do project-based learning too. And you talk to the physics teacher. You go, you know, I've always wanted to build trebuchets as part of your physics class. Like, hey, we have the tools now that we can like mass produce and 3D print or laser. You need to have that as part of that. So failing to have like that teacher involvement is like a big part. You know, if you're going to have student involvement, you need teacher involvement because makerspaces are weird. If you don't get them up and running off the ground right away, it is so hard to get teachers and students to be using the space. So there needs to be a lot of excitement around it. I would say the fourth problem of it is that it is it's not funded long term. Mm. There's the belief that, well, I got X amount of dollars to buy all these things and we're done. A makerspace needs a perpetual budget. for supplies. Like, you bought a laser cutter. That's awesome. You spent like $7,000 on a laser cutter. Well, you need budget for wood. You need budget for all of those things that you're going to be cutting. Mm-hmm. 3D printers, you need to support for filament. You need duct tape. You need copper tape. You need wires. Like, those are the things that long term are forgotten about because you're excited. I got all this money and now boom. Well, you're going to need a few thousand dollars every year. And if it's a really big, crazy, awesome, busy makerspace, then you'll need more, right? Like the problem with a makerspace sometimes is that if it's very successful, it's going to cost more money to run. And I think sometimes we forget about that because a 3D printer is going to break and that's might cost money to repair. And, you know, you need those things. And so sometimes we forget about the ongoing costs, which I think sometimes is a deterrent for administrators, but it's about being creative with your budget, but also realizing this is important. Our kids are utilizing this. This is where we need to spend our money. I found that the best schools implementing makerspaces realize that and find the way to support it. And it's tweaking budgets here and there or holding fundraisers to support the budget over the course of the year. I know we'll be working on fundraisers at my school to support it because it's one of the things I encountered. I said, okay, cool. What's the budget for the makerspace going to be? And they said, well, we don't have a specific one. You know, it's overall into our tech budget. Well, that's cool. But if my tech budget requires me to purchase, you know, 3 new laptops for teachers because they break, well, then I don't have money to buy wood for my makerspace potentially, right? Mm. So, you know, doing a yearly fundraiser to raise just a few thousand dollars, you know, and then if it needs to be more because the makerspace is really going crazy, then maybe that's where the school will say, okay, we'll do half if you can raise the other half. And it might be finding local businesses. That's another great resource that sometimes people forget. And so that'll go to the problem number 5 is that we forget to include the community as part of a makerspace. There are so many people in your community that have skills, knowledge, connections that can help support learning that goes on in makerspaces. I just got a phone call from my brother yesterday who said that he had dinner with a contractor who said he had all of these old tools and was wondering if our makerspace wanted them. He goes, otherwise he was going to donate them somewhere else. But if our school needed, you know, these saws, these drills and things like that, he's like, I'm happy to give them to your school. And that's amazing. Like, yes. Like, and what better yet is if I could talk to him and have him come in and do just a little mini session for kids that are interested in using a drill press or design or things like that. So I think sometimes we forget to tap into our community. And, you know, if your school, if it's possible, to even open up your makerspace to the community, you know, whether that is on one weekend a month or whether it's an after school type of thing or having a parent's child like making night where kids can come in and show off the 3D printer and the laser cutter and things like that to their parents so they have a better idea of what's going on. So I think sometimes we just look at our school as just sort of this silo when we really have this whole community around it that can totally be engaged and supportive of this space. So I look at those are the 5 most common things that I see when putting together a makerspace that we forget to do or do and we shouldn't over the course of time. And I think my first book, Your Starter Guide to Makerspaces, touches on those. So if you're looking to build a makerspace from scratch, I wrote that first book based on my experience of building my first makerspace a few years ago. And these are all the problems I had, and here's how you can avoid them. So I definitely did that. And it's in the same vein as my new book, The Maker Mentality, using sort of pop culture references to sort of guide those connections to building a space.
That leads us nicely on to sort of book talk now. And you've kind of answered that question already, like, you know, this is the second book and how it differs from the first. And I mean, there is a ton of popular culture references in this book. You obviously know your geek lore. I'd want you on my pub quiz team. But aside from the kind of humor element, a lot of them, you know, they're metaphors or their descriptions or their kind of things like that. And tell us about why you felt the need to add those and to have them, you know, how they work in the text.
So I've read other educational texts and heady type books, and they're just really dry. I find myself having a very difficult time reading those type of books. And I think the average teacher has similar difficulties. And textbooks in general aren't meant to be enjoyable. they're informative. And I always write in both of my books, I wrote, you know, if you're looking for a book with graphs and charts and research, this is not the book for you. And I say, there's nothing wrong with those books. I think there are some awesome people, some of our friends of mine that write books like that. And that's cool. And I think there are some people that are like, I need the research and I'm a research person. I want data. Cool. Like, that's awesome. I have found in my travels that teachers want to hear from someone who did it. And they just want to hear the story. How did you do this? Hmm. Why did it work? What's that example, right? And so I approach my book the way I write on my website, which is just really informal and sort of like to the point in the sense of, this is what I wanted to do, this is how it worked out, and here's the story of why it worked and why it didn't work. I just found that teachers, and this is what they've told me, they're like, it's just funny and it's accessible. They're like, I can read something and laugh. And she's, and they've said, I don't do that when I read education books. Mm. Like, that's just not something that you do. So my book is really, I guess I would say, original in that point where it's an educational book, but it's also funny. And I think people that are into making, or even not those that are serious pop culture people, the references that I pull, some are obscure, but some are just, you sort of know. And in this new one, I couldn't leave out Doctor Who for all of my British friends out there. So I got my Whovian references. And I think it's those little elements that people have told me that are like, you know, you obviously cared enough and you obviously know your stuff. And that's the other part of it, is that, you know, teachers are very good at spotting frauds. You know, the fact that I can write so casually and I sort of just have these personal experiences, because I'm also still a teacher, I'm still in classrooms, that's also really important to teachers, because there are a lot of people that haven't been in an instructional setting in 5 or 10 years that are still telling teachers, you know, what to do. So by combining my experiences from just this school year with, you know, these pop culture references that run the gamut of 1970s up until present time, makes it just an easier connection for teachers that are looking for something fun, lighthearted, and educational at the same time.
I thought you were really honest about your own kind of background and your own mistakes. You told in elementary school that you weren't very good at art, and you know, and then you're like, I'm going to draw my own illustrations in my own book. You know, and art is in decline, and kind of, at least in the UK as well, we've seen drops in people taking art courses, and you know, teachers were lost 1/5 of teachers. I mean, is art in crisis in schools?
I think the arts are under attack for sure. And I know it's like a very violent way to describe it, but I feel like that's where we're at. There are parts of the world that have this old style mentality of, you can't get a job with an arts degree. You know, so why would you take an arts? All of the research tells you that kids need to take art. They need to take music. They need to take these things because it actually develops a part of the brain that is super important when it comes to learning. And it drives me nuts when they're, you know, science denying is a different issue that's also sort of coming up too. Like this idea that, you know, science is, you know, subjective. Like, that's like your opinion. No, it's science. Like, it's a science is not opinion. Science is science. It's things that have been tested and proved and things like that. So that's like a different issue, but it's sort of side by side with the arts in the sense that people just choose to be selective in regards to what science they want to listen to. Mm. And the science is there. And it's not even new science. It's not like this came out within the past 2 years. This is decade-old research that have told you, wow, kids that do instruments from a young age, kids that are involved in arts at a young age, excel in learning. And they excel at creativity, which is linked to problem solving, which more than anything else in the world is what we need, because we as adults and our forefathers have created serious problems that right now we are dealing the consequences with. One example would be our plastics problem. Like, that is a legitimate environmental world ending issue that we're having, where essentially we need to deal with it. And, you know, you're seeing more and more stories of whales being beached and they do an autopsy and they find tons, literal tons of plastic in their system. And that is not a sustainable model. It's just not, you know, we can't do it. So we need kids to be able to solve that. And it drives me nuts because there are a lot of kids that feel like they don't matter in schools because the arts are where they excel. And that's heartbreaking. And so when you have a kid who feels that what they are good at or what they believe they want to do is invalid, why are they going to put in the effort and everything else? Because they have to. This is 2018. You know, we have to stop treating our kids like they are factory workers, because they are not. The Industrial Revolution model of education needs to die. And it's slow. It's a slow death. It's been painful, because we've been way past this model, I would say, since probably the 90s. Mid-90s is when we should have been making this transition. And only now in 2018 are we like, oh, you know, maybe we should do it differently. But we'll essentially only do it at private schools because, you know, as a public education system, that's just too much money to deal with. And, you know, whatever. We'll just keep testing kids. And that's how it works. It's just frustrating. I'm lucky enough to be at an independent school now that values project-based learning. It values the arts. And the success that we see from our students is there. It's just, without a doubt, you can see it. And it's so powerful to see these kids recognize their skills and see their value. And I think it'll be one of those things in the history books where we look back and go, wow, we really dropped the ball on that. Like, it'll be recognized as a dark period of education where the arts disappeared, and we will have afterwards a renaissance. I mean, it'll mirror sort of historically what happened, right? You can suppress the arts for a while, but you can't suppress it forever. Humans by nature are makers and artists. It's one of the very first things we put on cave paintings. Mm-hmm. We wanted to draw. We wanted to create. So you can try to hold that back, but the arts always come back with a vengeance, because artists find a way. That's like my favorite thing. Artists find a way. And if it has to be subversive, I am all for it. I tell my kids, go for it. I'm like, do your art, show off your things, because in a world without art, it's just a sad, dreary place. And we're already kind of there. Like, I can't even imagine getting sadder or scarier. So we need the arts for a lot of those reasons. But most importantly, it aids in creativity, critical thinking, problem solving across the board.
A huge thank you to Nick there for giving up his morning, as it was for him, and afternoon for me, to talk about all things makerspaces. His book sounds great. And if you'd like to win a copy of Nick's book, as well as a shiny new pie top to put in your makerspace, here's how to do it. Go to pietop.com/thenerdyteacher. Simply enter your details there and we'll put you in the prize draw. That's all from this episode of We Make the Future. Remember, there's episode one if you've not had a listen to that. That's discussing change in the classroom with Dr. Bill Rankin, PyTop's Director of Learning and Research. Next week, we've got another great interview. I'm keeping it under wraps, but do stay tuned. And if you want to feature in the podcast, or you think there's somebody I should speak to, please get in touch via Twitter. It's the quickest way. We are @PyTop on Twitter, and we can see about meeting up or doing something fun. Until then, goodbye.